Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we're also joined by our regular guest, Eric.
G'day, good to be back.
Yeah, it's been a while. What was the last one you were on?
Maybe Rushmore? Maybe there was another one in between.
Surely, Rushmore was once number 65.
Yeah, that was ages ago. I think there was another. I don't know what it was.
Yeah. But anyway.
It can't have been that good then.
No, I remember enjoying it.
Yeah. But we just finished watching the Soviet Union film from 1959, directed by Grigory Chukrai, called Ballad of a Soldier.
That we did.
We did. Mm. Who wants to do plot synopsis? Tom's just
immediately
staring
Eric,
at Eric.
Yeah, I'll do
He's
it.
The guest.
Tom kind of didn't understand the start. No. No.
Well, in his defense, the subtitles were black on black.
We were plagued. It's a black and white film, and the subtitles were black. So it was a bit trickier than usual.
Well, you guys got it.
Chris and I read the screen. Tom didn't. Basically, I think it, from memory, it opens on a long road out of a little Russian village with a mother staring down the road. And a narrator reads over the top about how so many soldiers went off down the road and didn't return. And essentially, this is the story of this woman's son. And then it flashes back in time, I guess, to the front where we meet Alexei, or Aloysha.
Yep.
Which we're guessing is a nickname for Alexei. And he does a bit of a kind of accidental hero thing, I guess. He's afraid of some approaching tanks and runs away, but ends up sort of finding, standing his ground and destroying them, becomes a hero, and is granted 6 days leave to return to his hometown, fix his mother's roof, and return to the front. And so we follow him on his journey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very succinct, yeah.
Yet again, another film of war, but never on the front.
Yeah, which seems to be a bit of a theme for what was happening in this kind of phase of war cinema, and what I like doing a bit of research today is known as the chill period of the Cold War. Sorry, the thaw period of the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
where it was, you know,
less icy.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, so they were able to actually do, to some degree, anti-war films.
Yes.
And, I mean, The Cranes Are Flying was a prime example of that. And, I mean, I think all over the kind of Eastern Europe at that time we were having, there were other similar films like Closely Watched Trains as well as another one that, from that same time period, it's, again, about the war without showing the war and has a very kind of anti-war message at its heart. That one a little bit more so than
these
other two. And I think this one, out of all of the ones we've seen, is probably the least kind of on the nose, like, not on the nose, like, least preachy and kind of hammering home that much of a message. This film just kind of, I think, works to humanize.
Yeah, it's a bit more subtle. And like Chris was saying, from our rusty knowledge of the Cold War, this was filmed in 59, I think. So Stalin, apparently, we had a quick look up, passed away in 53. So Khrushchev was in charge, and that was sort of the cruisiest part of the Cold War up towards the end, from our rusty knowledge.
Yeah.
Feel free to tweet corrections.
Yeah, my knowledge is so rusty, it just does not open anything. It's like a gate that is permanently closed. So excuse our history knowledge on this one, but it's, we'll just view the film as the film. But, I think, I don't know about you, Tom, I was kind of approaching this one, like, knowing that it was in the same kind of vein and kind of put alongside The Cranes Are Flying, so I was trying to view this kind of separate from that, even though they are kind of somewhat similar, but not at the same time.
From a film, like a technical standpoint, it's not relying on the visuals so much.
Which is
interesting. It was a stronger narrative push for the characters and dwelling on that as opposed to trying to unlock the symbolism through the visuals.
That being said, there were some very wonderful visuals within the film, and like certainly some stylistic elements that are used to enhance specific moments, but it's nowhere near the level of visual storytelling that The Cranes Are Flying was on.
No.
And reading up a bunch of the reviews, it seemed like people are putting it on that same level, but I just don't see that personally.
Was Cranes Are Flying by the same director?
No.
No, okay.
an older director, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, from what I was reading, like, the I forget the director of Cranes Are Flying's name off the top of my head, but he was kind of considered the old guard, whereas this Grigori Krychak, super hard to pronounce. Yeah. Chukrai. Grigori Chukrai is kind of considered, like, the young pup. He actually served in World War II, and he was kind of trying to infuse his sensibilities of what he'd gone through into the film.
So, if that's true, then is how much of the story is relying on his experiences?
That's interesting, because he also wrote the film. So, yeah, whether or not he... I know he was a, like, commended war hero, but it wasn't...
It's not a biopic or anything.
Yeah, I don't think he got 6 days leave to go fix his mother's roof, and he, spoiler alert, didn't die. So
it sounds like it's kind of a fantasy of his, potentially, if he's at war and he's thinking all the time, man, if I could only just go home for even just a couple days.
I think that's any soldier's fantasy, is to be able to leave the front for just a day, even just to hug their mother one last time.
Yep.
But I think what he's doing with the narrative is, it's, like I said before, it's just trying to humanize the soldier. And, like, I would imagine post-World War II there was a lot of... Or maybe not post-World War II so much, but, you'd have the idea of a soldier being, like, this tough, kind of manly, strong man, and, like, actually showing depicting a soldier as someone who is compassionate and caring is probably not what was more commonly in the zeitgeist at the time.
Particularly during the Stalinist period,
yeah,
where it was all about image.
Yeah.
And yes, you represented your country, and all the statues and everything were of powerful, strong people. And there was just showing the glory and the power of the USSR. And yeah, this follows Alexei, who is, he's a handsome actor. He's a bit of a young Casper Van Dien. That's what I got anyway.
That's a good pull.
But no, they don't. They still
he's doing his part.
Yeah, he is doing his part. And they still cast the young attractive. He's a 19-year-old character, at least.
Age appropriate as well, which is nice to see.
Yeah, he looks 19.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a very... I mean, his opening scene of becoming a hero is him running away from tanks, and then when it looks like he's going to get run over, he then stands up for himself. So it's not as though he's a war hero on purpose. He's sort of an accidental war hero.
And even to that extent, like, when he's the general is offering him a commendation, he's like, oh, actually, can I not have that?
Mm.
Like, he's just like, I just want to go home and fix my mother's roof. Like, that's all I want. Like,
well, straight away, I mean, I wasn't expecting the authority to say, like, yeah, leave the front, man. Just, go and see your mum and have a good time.
Yeah, we're all a little bit puzzled by that.
But I suppose that's what you're talking about with the whole, like, Stalin thing. You'd expect that. Like, the brute force soldier to be, at the front at all times, no matter what.
Yes.
And then to have, like, a story just fall back on, like, cruise back to the homeland.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And to kiss and hug your mum.
This showed none of the authority figures in the army to actually be jerks.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the general who gave him leave was the friendliest guy in the world. And later there was a lieutenant who was guarding a train who was always spoken of as a beast and don't let him catch you. And they turned out to be hilarious and loved the war hero and just picked on the guy who was eating their spam.
Yeah, which I think Tom... Was it you, Tom, that said, like, yeah, he's a beast if you're an absolute cunt to people? Like, that's why he's a dick.
I did say that.
Yeah, that's a direct
line. Like, if you're an actual good person, he's not a beast. Yeah.
So all the authority figures were shown to be very friendly and, yeah, we'll give you what you want, Whereas the history here of the World War II is Russian lieutenants would shoot deserters.
Yeah.
And people who turned around during combat and tried to run away, they would just shoot them. The sort of the stories you hear, this painted a very much more friendly, compassionate view of the military.
Well, that could take us onto an interesting kind of point from there. Then, if you could consider this film to be, in that regard, somewhat of a fairy tale, in that it's a kind of twisted idea of, like, not twisted in a good way of, like,
yep,
taking what is a normal scenario and then kind of heightening it and kind of turning it on its head, and that's when you can have those oddly hyper-real moments and the kind of bizarre, surrealistic stuff, like the bubbles raining in the building as they're, like, walking up the stairs. It's, like, this wonderful little bits of imagery and stuff, like adding to
like
this
a the fantasy to it.
Yeah, like a like a fairy tale kind of reality to this story of a guy being able to hug his mum one last time.
Even all a lot of the music when there's the trains rolling on, you get these kind of, I think Eric, you said Disney.
It was so Disney.
It was very Disney-esque kind of tunes, and it's lovely, but it doesn't.
It doesn't match what you'd expect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is pleasant, though. It's a nice...
it worked really well with the type of film and the way it was shot as well.
Yeah. It's also one, like... For a war film, there's really probably only one bad thing that happens in the film, and it's not even necessarily directed, like, because of the... It happens, obviously, because of the war, because that's what's happening in the country, but it's not a direct... cause and effect thing. It's the woman having the affair. Like, that's really the only negative thing that happens to Alexei. Like,
yeah, the only character he meets that he disagrees with who they are and how they're behaving, really.
Yeah, I mean, you do have the jerk who's on the train, but he gets punished for being a jerk. Like, it's...
But Alexei's not combatant against him like he was with the wife.
I think that was making a stand or something. Like, it wasn't necessarily
with the dude with the beef.
I'm talking about with the wife, like taking back the soap. I don't think that was necessarily,
like, he clearly disagreed, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Whereas with the fellow with the beef, he was more just like, hey man, okay, you know, I understand the situation, and let's just cool off and talk about it. But with her, it was like, I'm taking the soap back and I'm leaving.
I'm taking this gift and I'm giving it to someone who deserves it.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So it was more of a shaming as opposed to a, like, act of aggression, I guess.
Mm. But it does, the film shows a lot of what would have and did happen during the war, and that is wives who gave up on their husbands who had been at the front for a long time, fathers who were missing their sons and were glad to hear they were alive and were proud of them, mothers who just loved the fact that they could hug their son one last time, hoping it would be more than that.
No,
at the start of the film implies that he's not coming back, so
and then it kind of doubles down on that at the end of the narration as well, saying
he's a soldier, always will be.
he could have been that.
Yeah, and I guess that, I mean, jumping straight to the end, but that exact thing is the closure of the film, saying he was a soldier, and he always will be a soldier of the of Mother Russia or whatever
he
it was.
He will always be a Russian soldier.
A Russian soldier, that's right. And that sort of, to me, made it sound as though that film was almost like a homage to all Russian soldiers.
Yes, yeah.
So this guy might have been a fairy tale, sort of, he got his wish, sort of thing, but like so many other Russian, millions of Russian soldiers, he didn't go back home.
Yeah.
So is that what it's trying to do? Like, it's trying to paint an image of the kind of
perfect
Russian soldier, where you care deeply for everybody around you, and you want the best out of everything for everyone, but then you'll always come back and fight for it as well.
Maybe, except that the girl he met on the train, Shura, another stowaway, she said he was unlike anyone she'd met before.
Oh yeah.
So I don't think, it's an interesting one, because I don't think they were trying to paint him as a... the movie never felt like propaganda.
No.
And even that
final line, there could be a case made for it being a little bit in that vein, but I don't think that's what the film is trying for at all.
No, I mean, it ended on a sad note, it didn't end on a glorious...
Yeah, and triumphant. I suppose, I mean, what it's trying to do is, it's that kind of almost, I don't... Lead by example is not the right way to kind of phrase it, but it's the thing of, like, he's a Russian soldier, this is what it should be.
Yeah.
A genuine nice person who cares.
He wasn't born to be a soldier.
Yeah.
He was born to meet a girl, a nice girl. He was born to fix his mother's roof.
Yeah.
He had to go to war for his country, and he died for his country without really ever being suited for that or wanting to do that, and it highlights how many other people, I guess.
That's what a Russian soldier was. It was just someone who was...
Well, there's your anti-war messages.
Yeah.
He could have been all these things, but he couldn't because there was a war.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah,
whereas I guess a propaganda piece would just be more along... You'd probably imagine be more along the lines of, like...
It would be like, you took out two tanks, get out there, buddy, and do it again.
Yeah,
and he'd just be always leading from the front, and he'd be doing everything for the country, rather than this. His entire objective is to get back home and at least hug his mother for... 30 seconds?
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, if it was the more propaganda, he would have had that chiseled jawline, like that one-legged soldier, which is also an interesting thing you could say of what you would stereotypically think as the typical Russian soldier guy is the guy who is... Yeah, the archetype is the man with one leg who is feeling, like, a lot of shame and pity and is, like, going back home. Like,
yeah.
It's a really kind of toppling of that kind of trope, I guess.
Because he meets a lot of people along the way, doesn't he? So when he first leaves the front line, he meets, at the river crossing, he meets the guy Pavlov,
yep.
who wants him to take soap back to his wife, because she lives in the hometown near him.
And to the extent that all of the platoon agree to give, they're like, pushing, like, give all the soap, like, yep. so he can...
Our 2 bars of soap assigned to the entire platoon, give it to him to take back to his wife.
Yeah. So that, like, exemplifies the camaraderie and stuff, I guess, but...
Yep. And then there's the one-legged soldier waiting for the train. Then there's... there's the train guard.
And then Shura.
And then Shura, the girly mates on the train. They spend most of the movie together. And then along the way, he also meets the wife eventually.
The father.
The father of Pavlov, the soap guy. he meets a Ukrainian family fleeing the war to go inland to work in the factories.
Basically, he's Forrest Gump.
Yeah, like it's a journey, and you follow him along the way.
And he's just he's very reactionary to what he encounters. He never really for the most part, doesn't instigate the things. He's just like, okay, cool, yeah.
Yeah, like the only time he's proactive with. Well, when they give him the soap, he takes the soap.
Yeah.
He's proactive in helping the one-legged soldier. He takes his suitcase
for him.
And then he...
This is empathetic. That's
yeah, he's an empathetic guy. He's got feelings.
Yeah. So many feelings.
All of the feelings.
Yeah. but yeah, I think the apart from those kind of few instances, he is just kind of rolling with whatever comes his way. And I think they're using that as a nice little device to just show you what the war-torn countryside and how it's affecting different people in different parts of the country, and it's giving you that wonderful little snapshots across Russia as to like how far-reaching and to all kind of sectors it was.
Yes, like everywhere he goes is still affected by the war in some way or another. Like the near the front line, of course, he passes by a lot of soldiers. When he tries to find Pavlov, the soap man's wife, her building has been destroyed, so he has to get directed to another building. Even when he gets back to his own hometown, his train gets bombed along the way.
And the bridge has been blown out.
The bridge has been destroyed, so that affects his journey.
Glorious miniatures.
Yeah, some miniatures got destroyed.
Oh my god, they were fantastic.
And then finally, when he gets back to his home village, there's like no men, and he's basically offered his pick of the women.
Yeah. But he's like, but I gotta go.
He's like, oh, I gotta leave.
Yeah.
So it shows how the war affects every aspect of Russian life without actually attaching any actual politics to it or anything like that, really.
Yeah. Which I think was somewhat what the previous couple of films have done as well.
They're almost. Like with what was it, Cranes of Flying is like doesn't really attach an actual year to it, and it really feels like it's just a wartime as opposed to, you know, World War II, 1945, whatever. And so in that respect, you don't need to have the politics and the history running through. It's just like a
snapshot.
You're
just associating it with World War II because of time and place,
It becomes like a people study, right? As
yeah.
As opposed to like a time and place thing so much.
It's not studying one particular event or battle or anything like that. It's
like a human condition kind of situation.
Yeah. Regular humans in Russia during World War II.
But how... I kind of want to... To me, I mean, I'm going to compare this to The Cranes Are Flying a lot.
Yeah.
Because I really liked that movie.
Mm.
It was a great movie.
Yeah, it sounds like I should sit down and watch that one.
But that one was stunning in terms of direction, cinematography, and obviously kind of like, you know, well, mainly the cinematography because you're going to have all this like symbolism all through it. But this one was not so much in that vein. And so I'm trying to figure out... what makes this film really special? What's like the driving force to put this firmly into the collection? Is it the way that you portray a character and let the characters kind of steamroll the story along. And you obviously we all got drawn in. It was good that way. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think that's probably, like, for me, that's what I would say. It is the narrative and the character study that makes it interesting and kind of stand out, because it is not what you would stereotype, like, it's not what you think of with a war film. Even a character-driven one, it's so kind of unique, or, like, I'm sure there are probably other ones like it, but it's... Again, that's... I think of, like, a way to do this without comparing back to the Cranes Are Flying, because we're doing that much.
So, Cranes Are Flying, was that a bit more war-based? Like,
No, there was no war. There was a smidgen of a scene, like in this one.
That's why they are kind of very similar. I think they were made 2 years apart. And
the closest thing this movie reminded me of, and it's quite different in message, but it was Born on the 4th of July.
Oh, yeah.
That's a bit different, because that's pretty blatantly anti-war. And this is... but that one is very, and obviously that goes hand in hand with Platoon and the other one,
Heaven and Earth.
Chris.
Oliver Stone's War Vietnam trilogy.
His Vietnam trilogy.
So
this reminded me of that a little bit, but in this case, obviously the war was still going and stuff. And
yeah, but I think using Boar on the 4th of July, like, that is a film that is very on the nose and very explicit in its anti-war message. Very violent and very overt. Whereas this is very kind of... It's a subtle little character piece.
Yeah.
Like, it could even be taking place, like, if they could have omitted a whole bunch of stuff about, like, he has to go back to the front. And it could just be a soldier going home.
Yes.
And it would be the same impactful story, and you'd get the same message across. I think the fact that...
But that's like Saving Private Ryan, though. It's like... hunting down a character just to get them home again.
I think ultimately for this one, it was such a personal journey for that guy. Like, he spent so much, so he had 2 days to get home, and then he was awarded 2 days at home to fix his mum's roof, and then he was allowed 2 days to get back to the front. He spent so much time getting home, missing trains, helping other people, hanging out with Shura, delivering soap to someone else, that by the time he finally managed, and the bombed out bridge as well, by the time he finally managed to hitchhike a ride to his town, he had time to arrive and hug his mum and leave.
Yeah.
So it was such a personal journey at the end, from going home to help at home to just going home.
Yeah.
For a hug.
Yeah.
And that was it. And that hug was really well done, actually, because they switched off all the music.
Mm.
There was no sound at all until she had, like, a little sob about 25 seconds into the hug. And it was actually, I personally found it a really, like, well done, touching scene. He finally made it home. We thought that we were going to miss each other in the fields.
Yeah, I was kind of setting it up.
Yeah,
for that.
She was working in the fields, and he went to the house, and she wasn't there. And
how pissed would you be if that was the case?
Yeah, oh, I would have been shattered. That would have made it a bad film.
like, it really kind of would. You need that moment of closure. Like, you've gone on all this fucking way. Like you know he's not going to fix the roof. Like, just give him a hug at least.
I almost would have been happy for them to close the film with the hug. Like, just a silent hug, and then film's over, because you already know that he's not coming back from the introduction to the film.
Yeah. I know, that could have left it a little bit
ambiguous.
Like, you needed to have him head off, and you needed to have that final narration.
The final narration was good. It closed it nicely. Yeah. It had a good message.
Which, hate to bring it up again, but, like, similar with The Cranes Are Flying, where you're like, I understand what this film is doing, what your overall message is, but it's that final narration that fucking hammers it home, and it's just like, yep, there we go.
Yeah.
Like the friend doing the speech on the train.
Yeah.
It's a similar kind of thing here.
That was maybe two sentences at the end of this one.
Succinct and just yep.
To the point. Made it clear that this didn't just happen to him, it happened to millions of soldiers across, and families across Russia. And the other good emotional part of the film probably was him and Shura's relationship. Like, he met her on the train, tried to sexually assault her, because that's what guys do apparently.
Russians.
Yeah, apparently.
These films have taught us anything.
Yeah, from what I've heard.
We don't mean that.
No. But that did happen. But that was after being friendly to begin with. He felt he was getting mixed messages or something. Anyway, they end up becoming friends and discussing friendship. And then at the end, he realised, oh, maybe we like each other, but that was his, like, his train was rolling away, and she was left on the platform.
Yeah.
And you kind of left with that, oh, what if?
Yeah.
And that was all you're really left with.
But that's also how the film itself ends.
Exactly. So many what ifs. Yeah. And I think that tied in really nicely with so many of the other points of the film.
There was some great cinema magic with those two on screen as well. I mean, especially when they kind of had that moment of realization where they're kind of really into each other. And I don't know, man, like, old black and white movies, they seem to do the romance scene the best, where it's just like female, male, or, you know, whoever's in love with each other. The lighting, like that white glow is just like, you can't do it with color, it seems. You need to, I don't know, I can't even think of a single film that's in color that can get that. The magic that's there.
Yeah, because that was a real scene where they were squashed on a cramped train, and they were sort of forced to hold each other in each other's arms.
Mm.
And they were stuck between carriages, so they're outside, so you sort of had a bit of sunset glow sort of thing on them, and there was smoke from the steam train and stuff, and the way that was shot and their realisation in their eyes. There was no kiss or anything like that, it was just kind of like a hold tight.
No, it was just a hug. It was just the glow.
Yep.
But it maybe, like, I don't know, Punch Drunk Love, they kind of do that well. With that, they don't do the glowing of the face, but that there's like those light kind of fluctuations of refraction and whatnot.
It never blossoms into that kind of romantic love per se, but I'd even argue In the Mood for Love to some degree, like showing a connection through lighting and stuff with the characters.
Mm. True, I think it's like obviously it's a different. You're gonna have to do something different with color, as opposed to black and white.
Mm.
Anyway.
But yeah, that was really well shot. It matched up really nicely with their relationship, and the music at that time was really good too as well.
Mm.
It's
a good soundtrack.
They used the music really nicely. Yeah, they had the magical music, the fairy tale style music. They had some nice, touching music, and then they cut the sound off for good effect.
Oh, fuck. Dog's pissing on the carpet.
Oh, yeah, that happens, you know.
Go.
Let's go, Z.
Let him go.
You dick.
So do we keep going?
Yeah,
fucking keep talking, guys.
Right, so while Tom's got his hands in urine,
the music, it kind of following on from that same point, it shows its moments as well to disappear.
Yeah,
like the confrontation with the wife about the cheating wife and him taking back the soap, and you mentioned already, like him, the hug with the mother and things at the finale. I forget the fire scene in the train.
Yeah, I don't remember if there was music before that.
I think there was.
Yeah.
Like during that action, like
the actual sequence of destruction.
Yeah, I think there was like big kind of bombastic music.
Yeah.
Kind of hiding it. I don't remember it just being the sound of fire.
No, because
that would have been a little bit more raw.
And they did it quite simply, like. With the cutting out of music is because when they were rushing off to find this guy's wife and they got led to this apartment by a kid with a little alarm clock and stuff, and they went skipping up the stairs to this fantastical music, and then when they got there they realised she was cheating.
Bubbles, we're
talking about how it was all that abstract and special, and then he got there and realised that she was cheating on him, and then all the music just sort of cut out.
Yeah.
And then the descent down the stairs was totally different time.
Clomping shoes and just sad.
Yeah. So the use of very sprightly music and then the total absence of music really rammed home the change in tone.
Plus how Shua reacted to the bubbles on the way up. She's kind of playing with them, and at the end, on the way down, she's almost going to play, but then she kind of brushes it aside.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah,
cool, man.
Yeah. It's a nice, shit, clever good. Touch, yeah.
I had a couple of quotes and about it, like, if you guys are interested. I could have saved this for trivia, but it kind of doesn't work for that.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd use it as a nice talking point. So the film actually, when it screened at the Cannes Film Festival, it was like this kind of unknown new director kind of going out, and at the his competition at the festival was Fellini, Bergman, Antonioni, Louis Bonwell, and Ben-Hur.
Yeah, right.
But there was a lot of press, obviously, because Fellini was there with La Dolce Vita, which is a film all about, I mean, like, it means the high life. Like, it's about excess and things. And there's a wonderful quote from Soviet filmmaker Sergei Gerasimov. He explained the film's fresh appeal was the pathos of Fellini in La Dolce Vita could be put this way. One should not live like this. The pathos of Ballad of a Soldier could be summed up as we should all live like this.
Oh, that's rad.
Yeah. I thought that was a nice...
Yeah, that's nice.
Kind of breaks it down simply.
Well, if it's your first film, you know, releasing, coming up, being shown against all those films, that's like a great comparative point, I suppose.
Yeah, especially like, because I want
to. If you're being compared to that, to a Fellini film.
Well, I think I want to say La Dolce Vita won the Palme d'Or that year, but then they also gave a special jury prize to Ballad of a Soldier, cool. citing it for its high humanism and outstanding quality.
Yes. So, pretty high quality, yes.
Yeah. But it's a wonderful, it's an interesting contrast to that, and in like a kind of post-war period where it was people trying to do excess and kind of build up society again and kind of show we're past that and we're doing this. This film kind of breaks it back down to this minimalist story of like, no, it's just be good.
Well, it's still championing like, you know, humans.
Yeah, it's some degree, a human spirit film.
Yeah, even though it's a reaction to a war, which is obviously shitty.
Yeah. No, but yeah, that's what I mean. Like, just be good. Just be a decent person. That's all you need to have a, like, you know, La Dolce Vita.
Right on.
Yeah. I don't know, was there anything else you guys wanted to bring up? No. Or?
I did enjoy the, I don't know, that's like a small point, but we haven't mentioned it, and I feel like I want to. We were talking about that train sequence earlier with the fire.
Mm.
And I really liked the use of the superimposed layer of fire.
Yep,
the fire. Over everything during that scene, just to give the impression of just like a burning furnace the whole time.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's just like a really cool special effect, which I noticed, which was really cool.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, and it just helped, like, because even one of the scenes it was superimposed over. So while the train was getting bombed and he was helping people off the train, and then there was one scene where a guy was clearly just sitting on the ground miles from the train getting his head bandaged, and they still had the flames over the top.
I know,
but it just keeps a sense of urgency and
the chaos,
it's not over yet sort of thing.
It's just a really nice lo-fi way to, you know, solve a problem of like, let's make this fucking shit intense for a
while. And this is the start of it, and the chaos is ongoing until the flames have disappeared off the scene. Like, even though clearly this guy sitting on the grass doesn't have fire all around him.
Yeah.
But you didn't. If you took that away, you'd break the immersion in that scene. So
it's a rad 1959 special effect.
Yeah. Well, just on that same note of the train scene, it's interesting the aftermath scene as well, when it's the hive of activity of like the nurses and everyone like coming in, doctors and like quickly trying to say help everyone in the morning, and he's being treated like shit. They're like, get out of the way, and he's being called good for nothing and stuff.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to see someone who has been the entire film praised as a war hero and like this wonderful man, yet when actually in a scene of like, granted, yes, he did save a bunch of people from that train.
He carried like at least three or four people.
Yeah, so he was still a hero. Yep. But it's when presented with actually doing like, you know, those doctors and stuff having to do their actual work there, it's just like, get the fuck out of the way, dickhead. It's all the artifice there of being a quote unquote war hero is just like, move, dickhead.
Time and place, man.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting kind of, especially show immediately after a scene where you're just like, top bloke.
Right, that guy just saved kids from a burning furnace, and we thought he might even die.
And then he's like, get out of the way,
move.
it's a wonderful kind of juxtaposition.
Yeah.
All right, trivia. What's up?
All right. So the film was actually nominated for an Academy Award. Before I kind of explain that, it started doing the rounds of European festivals and things, and then because it was in that kind of thaw period of the Cold War, there ended up being a cultural exchange between America and the Soviet Union, where I think Cranes Are Flying, Ballad of a Soldier, and one other film were kind of sent over and screened in the US as a kind of like, hey, they're not so bad thing. And as a result, the film was actually nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. It unfortunately did not win. But also in 1962, it was nominated for two BAFTAs. Best Foreign Actor for Vladimir Ishilov, who played
Alexei.
Yep. And it also won the BAFTA for Best Film. Not even best foreign film, but just best film.
Well, who do you know? Like who it was up against?
I can find that out.
Because that's quite abnormal to have
a foreign film
win in any year ever.
Yeah. I mean, how many foreign films?
I mean, you occasionally get foreign language actors winning best actor and best actress, like Roberto Benigni or Marion Cotillard. It almost happened again this year with Isabelle Huppert, but yeah, for an actual film, like sometimes you'll get the nominations, like Life is Beautiful or Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. They'll kind of sneak through like that, but it's very.
To actually win is a massive thing.
Yeah, I mean, the BAFTA's less so because the Academy Award love America and they love Hollywood so much.
And black people.
And yeah, if history's taught us anything. Oh, it turns out it was a tie. I did not know this. So it won Best Film, but it was Ballad of a Soldier and The Hustler, the fucking awesome Paul Newman
shark
movie.
Okay, fair enough.
It was nominated against...
Chalk and Cheese, yep. Yeah.
It was nominated against The Innocents, Judgment at Nuremberg, which is a great, great movie. The Long and Tall, The Long and the Short and the Tall, Rocco and His Brothers, The Sundowners, which is a great movie, A Taste of Honey, Whistle Down the Wind, Apu Sansar, which is part of the Apu trilogy by Satyajit Rai. We'll good eventually see that.
Yeah, I thought it was a Simpsons.
And,
and
it was also nominated against La Trau, a.k.a. The Tunnel, that Prison Break movie we saw.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. Yeah, as I previously mentioned, it was also nominated for the Palme d'Or at the 1960 Cannes Film Festival. It didn't win that, but it did win that Special Jury Prize Award I previously mentioned. Other than that, the only other real bit of trivia I have is that this film was actually, during production, was granted a little bit more leeway than most other Soviet Union productions were granted that time in terms of its message and its censorship, and that was because Nikolai Khrushchev was a fan of the director. So he was like, you can get away with a little bit more.
It's interesting, considering the director, this was one of his earliest films.
Yeah, yeah.
And Khrushchev apparently served in the war. The chances they served next to each other is probably pretty minimal.
Yeah, I think it might have something to do with the fact that this guy was a war hero, possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might not have been necessarily a fan of his work, more just, I'm a fan of you guy.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's pretty much it for trivia.
Yeah. It's still pretty, yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Hmm. So we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still in print through Criterion as a one-disc DVD. And it comes with the special features of a interview with director Grigory Chukurai and actor Vladimir Ishov and Zana... God damn it, I hate pronouncing these names.
You're doing such a good job, too.
Keep going, buddy. I believe in you, god damn it.
Yeah, nailed it.
Conducted after a preview screening in New York.
You got that one.
Yeah. New York? it also comes with the usual booklet and essays that Criterion I usually do. But I guess, unless you guys got anything else, that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode looking at Ballad of a Soldier.
I got nothing.
Got nothing?
Yep.
No.
I've checked out.
Checked out. if you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter at @CriterionQuest. Other than that, we will be back in a fortnight's time with another Fellini film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What one?
What's it called again? with Juliet of the Spirits. I have no idea. It's from 1965.
It's an interesting title. I'm intrigued.
Yeah, and it's Fellini. So
it's
I'm
Fellini.
Sure
no worries.
He's only, you know, out of all of them, only one's been not that great.
Oh, yeah, we had, like, a mixed run for a little.
Yeah,
it was, we weren't really sure about him. And
it was, and the ship, yeah, well, I mean, the only Fellini that was kind of missed for me was And the Ship Sails On, that kind of weird meandering.
Well, that was, like, the second one or something.
Yeah, and it was, like, 3.5 hours of just, like, these are people on a boat doing wacky stuff.
Yeah.
Oh.
3.5 hours, or whatever
it
was.
Don't recommend it?
No.
Okay.
If you want wacky, like, vignette Fellini, go for Amarcord.
Okay, yep.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess that'll wrap us up. For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Tom. See you next time.